It was 5 years ago today when the war in Iraq began. That's when Baghdad residents like Ahmed Abdullah first heard the sounds of the cruise missiles. Since then, his life has been marked by where he can't go and what he can't do.
It has been 2 years since I have been to a hospital, and not because I don't get sick. The health ministry and the hospitals in Baghdad are now known to be places controlled by the Shiite militia.
Here in the United States, the war has also changed many people's lives. Chris Higginbotham served for 4 years, left the military, and then got this letter.
It says, "Pursuant to Presidential Executive Order of 14 September 2001, you are relieved from your present reserve component status and are ordered to report for a period of active duty not to exceed 25 days for mobilization processing."
5 years of war and its effect on two people, one in Iraq, one in the U.S. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
It was March 2003 when shock and awe began, when the drumbeat of war started and the media tapped its foot in rhythm. At the time, there was excitement and fear, fear that Saddam Hussein would unleash his weapons of mass destruction, including chemical weapons.
The key moment when I realized it was going to happen was the day that they came to us and said, "All right, those chemical warfare suits that you were all given, that you kept in the plastic wrap, open them, put them on. The threat of chemical use is high.
The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near."
For some, though, the day of liberation has not yet come. Ahmed Abdullah is still waiting. Ahmed has seen every day of the past 5 years of war. He's the resident of Baghdad who files regular updates to The Story for his series, Ahmed's Diary. He watches this war as a reporter and as a civilian, a father and a husband. 5 years after the war began, Ahmed still waits for reliable electricity and for some expectation of safety in the streets. But he also waits for his nation to develop a system of justice and health care that works. Here's his latest story for Ahmed's Diary.
"I'm not sure that I ever told you this, but I was one of the journalists who attended the trial of Saddam Hussein. In fact, for a while, I was one of the videographers covering the Saddam trial. I used to zoom at his face to see the expressions of this who was once seen as an evil giant. And I used to think to myself while watching him standing in his cage, how many of the present government officials are going to stand in that cage after him? I don't mean Saddam's people, but I mean the criminals who are responsible for all the militias and death that has come to Iraq in recent years. I wondered if there would be a day when I can see those men brought to trial. But now, I'm not so sure. Some time ago, the American forces arrested two of the senior officials with the health ministry. They were Hakim al-Zamili and Hamid al-Shimari. And they were accused of serious charges, like kidnapping doctors and pharmacists. And they apparently used government cars to kidnap people and to take them to the basement of the health ministry and have them killed. Those two men are Shiite, and they have close ties to Shiite militias. When they were arrested, there were lots of witnesses ready to speak out against them, so everyone was thinking that they will be executed, and at least we will get rid of two more criminals. Who knows? After that, maybe we will live happily ever after. A few days ago, I was invited by the Americans to attend the Zamili trial, and I was thinking forward to finally seeing one of the hardest criminals brought to trial and punished. I wanted to see the brave people step forward and speak against those who murdered their beloved ones. It is time for us to face the evil. At least that's what I thought. But when the judge started to call the names of the prosecution witnesses to step forward, only one showed up, and he was too afraid to speak. The defense witnesses were all there. All of them are from the same gang. It was obvious that prosecution witnesses had been threatened. I was also told later that one judge resigned a day before the trial because his son had been kidnapped and beaten. The judge on that day was new. As a result, there was no evidence against them. The charges were dropped and they were released. What a shame. Many people were hoping to see them executed. Even the Americans. I spoke to one of the Americans who was in the courtroom to monitor the trial. He said to me, "I would have hanged them. We know that they have killed many people. But it's not our call to make. It is up to the Iraqi government." I am telling you this story because it is also has a real meaning to us Iraqis, particularly those of us who are Sunni. The health ministry and the hospitals in Baghdad are now known to be places controlled by the Shiite militia. It has been 2 years since I have been to a hospital, and not because I don't get sick. I have to go to private clinics with my family and friends, because it would not be safe for me to be sick in a government hospital. The problem is, everyone knows this is true, even the government, but they are not doing anything. They know that militiamen forced the nurses in the hospitals to put the wristband on the left arm of the Shiite patient and on the right arm of the Sunni patient, so they would know who is Sunni in order to kidnap him from the hospital or to kill him. What I am telling you is that it might seem more peaceful in Baghdad and in Iraq these days, but much of the country is still divided along Sunni-Shiite lines. We find it in our courtrooms and in our hospitals. I wonder if we will ever get away from all of this, if we will ever have the chance to live our lives in a place where we can trust a judge or take our child to see the doctor without having suspicions.
That's Ahmed Abdullah with his latest story for Ahmed's Diary. Our other perspective on this war today comes from the former U.S. Army Specialist Chris Higginbotham. Chris spent 4 of his past 5 years in uniform and a short period of time in Iraq.
And we would sit with a bug lamp and a CD player, and we would just sit in our flip-flops and our T-shirts and shorts, and we wouldn't really ever talk about anything. Have you ever had a conversation where you just didn't really talk about anything, but you just kept on talking? That's what we would do around this table, and we would count the number of bugs that were dying, and every now and then the ground would start to shake, which meant that someplace on base was getting hit. That was the closest you could come to really trying to separate yourself from what was going on the other side of the fence.
But Chris Higginbotham was far from such disillusionment when the war began. He was just finishing up college as the U.S. was invading Iraq in 2003.
I just remember being glued to the television. I normally was. During 9/11, I was glued to the television also. But I remember watching the embedded reporters down there and thinking that that just looked like a really cool job.
The Army's 3rd Infantry Division roared into southern Iraq with the 7th Cavalry leading the way.
We were the tip of the tip of the spear. We were farthest out in front of the regular army.
I remember two reports in particular. One was during the initial invasion, and this reporter who was embedded with one of the Marine units, the cameraman actually was ducking for cover behind the same mortar wall that the riflemen were ducking behind, and he just had this excellent shot of these guys just popping rounds back there, and I was like, you know, that is just an awesome place to go and tell stories. And I figured if there was one organization I could sign up for that would give me the opportunity to do that, it would be one of the military branches.
So you weren't interested in going to Iraq as a soldier to take part in patrols and the sort of stuff that most other people were signing up for?
I mean, I didn't join the Army to be gung-ho and to go out and pick
suit
fights
stuff,
or anything.
Right?
Yeah, that wasn't my primary intention. I mean, I'm proud that I joined. I'm happy to say that I served my country. But for me, you know, that went along with the fact that I got excellent training. And as I was signing up, I knew that it was an opportunity.
Did you think about contacting CNN and saying, hey, I'd like to go to Iraq as part of the media rather than going as a part of the military?
I thought about it, and in retrospect, I kind of think one of the reasons I joined the military was because it seemed easy to me.
Easy in that the shortest route to combat, or?
Easy in that I didn't really have to go to a job interview. They didn't ask me about my GPA. They didn't ask me for an air check tape, you know, or anything like that. I was going into the field of journalism very unprepared to be entering the field of journalism when I graduated. And so the Army kind of seemed like an easy way to get an excellent shot at doing something incredible.
It all began the way that Chris Higginbotham planned it. He got the training to be a videographer, a reporter with the Armed Forces Network, and he was sent overseas in the early months of the Iraq War. But from that point on, not much else happened as he might have hoped for it. More with Chris in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm taking a look back at 5 years of the Iraq War today, the call that was made, and one young man who answered it.
We understand history has called us into action, and we're not going to miss this opportunity to make the world more peaceful and more free.
Chris Higginbotham signed up in 2003 to work as a military reporter. He went to boot camp and then to Defense Information School.
They could have sent me, you know, to the 1st Infantry Division and said, congratulations, you're a radio operator, or you're a tank driver.
Or you're a broadcast journalist, here's a gun.
Yeah, keep the camera in your pocket, here's a rifle.
But what did they do? Where did they send you?
My orders were just for Germany. I didn't know what unit I was in. And I remember when I first set foot in Germany, I was in the ugliest, most depressing place on the planet. And I remember just feeling so homesick because I had no idea where I was going to go. And I remember that I landed there on a Friday and they changed my orders that day, which meant that I had to spend the weekend in this miserable place. This was at Rhein-Main Air Base, which was on the verge of being shut down. So I'm staying in these barracks. There's no one else there. It's just me. I wasn't allowed to leave the base. I wasn't allowed to go out and do anything.
But you are on your way to Iraq at this point, aren't you?
No, at this point I wasn't. I mean, I remember there were these chief warrant officers who were coming back from Iraq, and they wound up staying at that place. And I remember them saying, well, I know where you're going. You're going to 1st Infantry Division. You're going downrange. That's kind of a term for going to Iraq. Okay. Call it a sandbox or going downrange. Once they said that, I remember being like, well, that's what I wanted. But then I also kind of remember being like, I don't want to go and die or whatever. You know, I remember kind of feeling very conflicted in my head because, yeah, that's what I joined for, and it seemed very exciting. But it was also maybe just hearing someone say it kind of triggers, you know, there's a whole other reality to this aside from just the glory of going there and being able to run your camera and tell stories.
But I think any honest soldier goes through that moment of remorse before he or she gets on the plane, right?
Right.
I mean, that's not that unusual.
No, I hope not. And hopefully they just realize it before I did. But after that weekend at Rhein-Main, I got my orders to go to Kaiserslautern in Germany. I remember going down there and getting to my unit, and this crusty old master sergeant came and picked me up, brought me back to my office, and said, get to work.
What was your job to be?
I was to be the videographer for the 21st Theater Support Command. It's kind of like a big division, and underneath our master command was, you know, a series of brigades and battalions, all with different jobs. We had truck drivers, military police units, and whatever. My job was to find out when these guys were doing cool exercises or training missions, or, you know, when they deployed, sometimes we would follow them down and just do video stories about them and report on them.
The work in Germany, was a little bit frustrating for you?
Yes. Frustrating would be an understatement.
Chris had more frustration ahead. His commander kept talking about taking the team to Iraq, but Chris says it kept being delayed.
We had just gotten all this awesome equipment. I would bet we were the most well-equipped videography team in the United States military.
And you're sitting there with it all in cases in Germany?
Exactly, exactly. You know, we were shooting high-definition changes of command and high-definition awards banquets and cake cuttings and stuff like that.
Why didn't this commander of yours want to go to Iraq?
I don't know how to answer it because I don't know. The first time my boss set it up, we were going to go. We were going to leave on a Monday. And I remember on Sunday, my wife and I were going to the PX, the Walmart of the military. And my boss called me and said, Sergeant Higginbotham, just want to let you know, our orders have been canceled. I was like, why? And the story he told me was, he said, the person who's in charge of public affairs at CENTCOM in Iraq knows me and doesn't like me. And I think she booted us because of that grudge. He said the stated reason was because there were enough videographers down there and we didn't need more to go.
You're knocking on the door. You're saying, when are we going to go to Iraq? When are we going to go to Iraq? Why do you think it didn't happen?
I think the reason was that I was the only one in the office who really wanted to go. And, you know, I said, sir, why don't you just send me? Just let me go. And he kind of said, no, Sergeant Higginbotham, I don't send my soldiers by themselves. We go as a team. We're a team and we operate as a team. And I just remember saying to him, sir, this isn't a movie. You know, this is reality. There's 130,000 soldiers down there who have my back every bit as much as you do. I'll be fine. And he said, sorry, Sergeant Higginbotham, I just have some rules that are steadfast that I stick with.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Chris Higginbotham did go to Iraq. He was there for a month. At the outset, he was to be attached to a military police unit with the mission to run patrols on major supply routes.
We hop on this convoy, and we're with this reserve unit from New England. And I just remember the guy riding shotgun. I was in the back seat behind the driver. The guy riding shotgun was operating the radio, getting these calls about small arms fire coming up ahead of us, RPG fire coming up on the left.
Is it two? Man, you got shots fired down where you're at?
11, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
I got shots fired.
Automatic gunfire.
Five shots so far.
He said automatic gunfire.
We got automatic gunfire.
He would answer the calls like 10-4, roger. And then he would look back at me and ask, so what do you do? What were you doing back before you joined the Army? And I was like, dude, just look straight ahead. Just look out there and let's keep our sectors going here. And then the gunner's up above me. He just looks down. He's like, are you nervous? Like, yeah, when you're not looking around, I'm a little bit nervous. You know, I just remember at this point, their calmness was not infectious. You know, I just remember hearing all those calls on the radio and just kind of freaking out.
Was there any fire coming in or no?
I didn't see any at that point. I mean, it was coming in over the radio, but for the most part, those attacks are usually pretty brief. You know.
And you're doing what at this point, Chris? You have your camera in your hand waiting for some activity or it's all packed away? What's
going
on?
First day, I did not pull my camera out of that box. I had my rifle like this. I mean, my hands, I've never held anything so tight as I was holding my rifle right then. It was really something else. It was a real shock to be there that first day. But then after a while, you know, after we passed through the bad sectors, I fell asleep in the back seat for like the last 20 minutes of the drive. My first day with the actual units we were covering. We were supposed to go on this joint patrol with this Iraqi police unit who had just graduated from the academy, most of them. So we go to the Iraqi police station. They wind up having to back out. The second we left the protective gate at the police station, I heard something. I don't know what I heard, but everybody kind of bowed up and got into kind of combat mode. They had been pretty relaxed.
What had you heard? An explosion? Well,
apparently what I heard was the sounds of bullets ricocheting off the top of our Humvee. I remember the radio starts squawking like crazy, and we are just pulling a U-turn right in the middle of a highway. It was kind of one of these highways where there's a road that runs parallel to the highway, and we thought the shots had come from some houses over on that road, so we just run over the median, and there's a hole in the protective fence on the side of the highway. We cut through that and start driving in circles around this building, and I didn't realize that the other three vehicles, they stopped, dismounted, started clearing houses. My vehicle was doing rotating security, and we could hear the squawks on the radio, and they would just come in and be like, "Corner the right, check out that rooftop. You see anything up there?"
"Corner on the right of the rooftop. You see anything?"
"I don't see nobody on the rooftop."
"Keep your eye on the corner of that rooftop."
"Which one? The one in front of us?"
"Right on the right side of us, right in front of you."
And my truck commander is yelling at the gunner, "Check out that building, check out that building." You know, negative, nothing up there. Then we get a few more calls on the radio that are like, "Vehicle leaving the premises." So we start chasing this vehicle. We hear automatic gunfire. And I'll remember this. The gunner just yells, "We got automatic gunfire, 10, 15, 20 shots. And the commander's like, "Shoot, shoot." He's like, "I don't have a target." And it was exciting, it was confusing, but when I had my camera, I didn't have time to register fear. It was more just excitement.
So you were doing what you set out to do
exactly,
months earlier, right?
Exactly, and got great footage of it. I mean, I was very proud of that day.
It's a frustrating end for a situation like this, but no one ever said the job would be easy. From Baghdad, Iraq, Specialist Chris Higginbotham, 21st Theater Support Command.
We just sat there, smoked cigarettes, and basically rehashed what had just happened. I got a couple interviews while we were out there. And
what were you thinking at the time? What was going through your mind?
At that point, I just remember being very excited. I was like, I could handle a year of this. I remember thinking that. I was like, I could handle a year of this. Every day like this, this is awesome. I remember just a lot of adrenaline. I remember being just covered in sweat because it was June in Iraq. And, you know, we had all that armor on and our helmets and everything. And I remember Major Wright coming up and slapping me on the shoulder and being like, "That was awesome, wasn't it? That was awesome." And, and I remember thinking, because I was very nervous when I first got in the vehicle with these guys. And I remember thinking, I really feel close to these guys now. We weren't talking, and that wasn't what made me close. It was just going through that with those troops really made me feel close to him.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chris Higginbotham would shoot video every day he was in Iraq, sometimes out on patrol, but often it was less exciting, like those video letters home.
We would set up every evening the camera outside this one trailer. We call them high honeys.
High honeys.
Yeah, we call them high honeys, and it's just basically we would set up a video camera. If they wanted to be left in there privately with the camera, I would allow that, but they would just send a message to their wife, husband, children, parents, whatever.
You wouldn't ask them questions. That was their moment to face the camera and say what's on their mind.
Exactly. I just hit record and said, "Talk to your loved one."
"Hey, Kristen, I just went to Happy Valentine's Day, tell you that I love you and I miss you, and I can't wait to be home with you and do all kinds of crazy stuff."
You really got to hear a lot of interesting things back then. I remember listening to a few of them, and just that kind of puts it in perspective, because you kind of forget not just the deaths that the human toll of the war, but also the separation really takes a toll on these guys, you know, and they would really kind of pour their hearts out as much as you can to a Sony video camera. Some of them were pretty touching. Guys who
got their wife pregnant and then got their orders and had to deploy, so the baby was born in absentia, you know, and they would, listening to them try to talk to somebody they've never met who can't understand them, you know, you'd see them reach out and they would touch the lens on the camera.
This would get to me if I was on the other side of the camera.
Yeah. And I just remember it really touched me. And it was almost weird. I don't know if they planned it, but all of them would reach out and just touch the lens of the camera like they were touching the kid on the cheek or something. It made me feel pretty guilty because I was only there for a month.
Chris Higginbotham says there were also people sending messages home, messages that kind of frightened him.
This guy who I was interviewing, he was your typical soldier. He was the cardboard cutout at the recruiting station.
Shoulders and, this wide.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Like 6'3", staff sergeant, just bulging out of his uniform. And he was doing his for his kids. He had two little boys. And this must have been fate, because while we're taping this, we start taking mortar fire into the base.
And he's saying into the camera, "Hey, Billy, hey, Michael, it's me, it's your dad, I'm blah, blah, blah."
Right. Okay. And the mortar fire interrupts him at that point. And he's like, "You hear that, boys? You hear that? We're coming under fire. We say we're under thunder when this happens. What this is when the bad guys, because they're too scared to fight, they start volleying rounds over the fence because they know they can't take Daddy." And I'm just sitting there like, "Do you want to cut it off? I mean, we can come back after this is over." He's like, "Oh, no, my kids are going to love this." And I was thinking, I don't know what I was thinking.
You didn't want to be there.
No, I didn't want to be outside anymore.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chris Higginbotham is remembering recording those messages he called "Hi, Honeys." During one, he heard a soldier tell his family that the war in Iraq was keeping the terrorists out of their backyard. Chris remembers thinking, "Are we really doing that?" And he says it was one of the first times he found himself questioning things.
I mean, the times that I would sit and talk with these people was actually while I was shooting the "Hi, Honeys." And we would sit with a bug lamp and a CD player, and we would just sit in our flip-flops and our T-shirts and shorts, and we wouldn't really ever talk about anything. Have you ever had a conversation where you just didn't really talk about anything, but you just kept on talking? That's what we would do around this table, and we would count the number of bugs that were dying, and every now and then the ground would start to shake, which meant that someplace on base was getting hit. That was the closest you could come to really trying to separate yourself from what was going on the other side of the fence.
The soldiers that you were talking to, were they telling you that they didn't think that what was going on in Iraq was the same story that was either being told on Armed Forces Network or the same story that we were seeing on the news back home? What were you hearing, though?
Sure, I heard both. I mean, I remember there's a certain amount of glory that comes to a unit when I would show up. They'd be like, "Oh, you're taping? Oh, that's awesome." You know, it's kind of a morale thing. But then there were people who were like, "Oh, so you're going to make a propaganda video out of us? You're going to objectify us for the great and noble cause or whatever?" I did meet a few people who did say they only watched the American Forces Network because the good news wasn't being broadcast out there, you know, on the real media. So I saw both of those.
So you did your month in Iraq, Chris, and then it was back to Germany. What filled out the rest of your 4 years?
A lot of the time that was passed in Germany was spent either doing stories on things like parades or ceremonies, or it was spent not doing much of anything. There was a lot of that.
So what were you thinking at the time?
I was thinking that I was pretty good at what I did, and there was a whole lot of other stuff I could be doing aside from just sitting at my desk checking my email.
So were you marking off days on the calendar?
Oh, yeah. I counted from 300 down.
May 27th, 2007. Chris Higginbotham finished his tour. He was out. He got a full fellowship to get his master's degree in journalism, and that was the new plan. That is, until the letter came from the Army saying that he was being involuntarily reactivated. Never mind school, it was time to go back to war. And Chris is not alone. Thousands of soldiers have been and are getting those same letters. I'll talk with Chris about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. On this fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq, I'm looking at the conflict through the eyes of one soldier who is being involuntarily reactivated. Chris Higginbotham had done his 4 years with the Army. In fact, he was near the end of his second semester doing his master's degree in journalism. But it wasn't to last.
Well, it was my birthday. It was the day before my birthday, and my folks called that morning and said they were going to come up and visit. My parents show up, knock on the door. I invite them in, of course. And my dad has an envelope, standard 8.5 by 11 manila envelope. And he says, "You got a birthday card from the Army." Ha, ha, ha. To him, it probably didn't seem like a big deal because I get lots of letters from the Army asking me to come back in. But when I saw it, I knew exactly what it was. I mean, this thing was the size of like a college admissions packet.
Yeah, but it could have been a folded up recruiting poster. Put this up at your school, no?
Could have been. Sure, it could have been. Maybe I'm kind of a pessimist. Maybe it's just a premonition. But I opened it up, and the first page on top of it is an activation order.
How does it read?
It says, "Pursuant to Presidential Executive Order of 14 September 2001, you are relieved from your present reserve component status and are ordered to report for a period of active duty not to exceed 25 days for mobilization processing." A little further down it says, "If you are found to satisfy medical deployment standards, then you are further ordered to active duty for a period not to exceed 400 days, such period to include the period required for mobilization processing."
How far into the letter did you really have to read to know exactly what it was saying?
The first sentence. Took the first sentence, and I knew.
What'd you think?
It was myself, my mother, and my father in the living room. My wife was taking a shower at the time. And I remember just kind of swallowing hard, and the first thing that came to mind was, I'm going to have to drop out of school. I'm going to lose my fellowship. I'm not going to get to finish my master's degree.
What did your folks say when you told them what the letter said?
My dad felt bad for making the joke when he came in about it being a birthday card. And he said, "Let me see it." And he walked over to me and grabbed it out of my hand, kind of like a father would do to a kid, even though I'm 28 years old now.
"Show me that report card."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. My mother reacted more in a motherly way. She said, "What? How can they call you back now? I don't say, you did your service. Your time's up. You know, you're done." And I didn't really know what to say to her. I was like, "Well, you guys voted for George Bush. That's why they can call me back."
Ow.
Yeah.
Now, your wife is in the shower. You've seen this letter. Your parents know what's in it.
Right.
How does she find out what's in it?
Well, she comes out of the shower and gets dressed. She's toweling off her hair and she walks in. And I think maybe 10 minutes have passed, but we're still not really talking. Melanie comes in and says, "Hey, guys," you know, to my folks. And my dad says, "Your husband's been reactivated to active duty." And I just looked at him like, "Dad, come on."
That was subtle.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't really mad at the time because my brain was kind of numb still. But she just got silent.
Melanie did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason she got silent is because she knew how gung-ho I was about going to Iraq while I was active. And I think she thought that I would look at these orders as a blessing.
Well, that was kind of in my mind. You were so eager to go to Iraq when you were being trained up the first time. And in effect, so caught up in the excitement of doing your work as an Army videographer while you're there. Why don't you even now see this as, okay, didn't work out the first time, second chance?
Well, part of me does kind of react in such a way as to look at it as an opportunity. What I was thinking of wasn't the fact that finally they're going to get to send me. I was thinking last semester, which was total hell, was for nothing. And I'm going to have to leave. We're going to have to move again. Say goodbye to all my friends. I have to go and visit everybody. I have to get all my paperwork in order. All in the next month. I had a month's notice at this point. It really made me mad. And I think a lot of it was because here I was for 4 years begging to go. And I never, never really got the chance to go the way I wanted to go down there. Now, I've moved on. I've got something else going on in my life, something I'm very proud of going on in my life. And now's when they decide that they need me.
I remember being really, really mad.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Chris Higginbotham has since found that he will not lose his fellowship at UNC School of Journalism, that he'll be able to continue when he's done his second tour of duty. But that, for him, is only some comfort.
When I come back, I'm not going to know anyone anymore. Everyone who I'm in graduate school with now, who I was admitted with, will graduate while I'm in Iraq. By the time I get back, everyone will be gone. And when I say that, it seems like a small deal. But to feel that, it really is a big deal. I've made better friends through the hell of mass media law than I made in the hell of going through the Army. We went through last semester together. All the master's students were miserable. But once we finally got our report cards, and once we were finally done, that sense of relief really led to a lot of camaraderie. And the fact that that's going to be gone when I get back bugs me more than most of the issues here.
You know that there will be people listening to our conversation who say, you know, tough, Chris. You signed up. You're in the reserves. This was quite likely going to happen. And really all you're complaining about is that it's inconvenient for you now. What would you say to them?
I would agree. Yeah, I am upset mostly because it's inconvenient. And in the grand scheme of things, maybe the fact that I'm in school now isn't a huge deal. But what bugs me about it is the fact that I feel that I've moved on. I'm not the person I was anymore when I signed that contract. I'm not the person anymore that I was on May 27th, my last day in the Army.
But you're what, Chris? You're older, you're wiser, you are politically opposed to the war and therefore ideologically determined not to go. What do you mean by I've moved on?
I don't think it has to do with my politics as much, really, because most of the people who are down there aren't fighting as part of their politics. You know, when you're down there, you're not thinking...
Yeah, for a lot of people, it's a job. No question about it. I understand
that. Well, you're thinking about the guy next to you.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
But the fact that, and I'll say this for all the troops who've been down there and people who've had to get called back, they've done their part. We've done our part. And I feel that it's time for other people to start pulling some weight in the war.
Are you saying that rather than be called up again, time for a draft, time for everybody to be forced to spend their time in support of the war in whatever capacity? What are you saying?
This will be controversial, but I do support a draft. And I don't support a draft simply because I think it's time for other people to pull some weight, but I also think it's time for us to have more weight behind our decisions here. I think we've run this war in such a way that we've been able to run under the guise of having an all-volunteer military. Yes, we're putting a lot of pressure on these guys, but it's an all-volunteer military. These people knew what they were getting into. They're behind their cause, and they're going to fight for it because they're volunteers. I think if we had more people involved in this and the weight of our decisions affected more people than those who signed the paper voluntarily, we would probably put more consideration into what we decided to do from now on. And the whole all-volunteer military thing, I think, is kind of killed because there's two words on here, involuntary reactivation. Those are the Army's words on this piece of paper, involuntary.
That's what you're facing, involuntary reactivation.
So it's not an all-volunteer military. I'm not the only person who's getting called back involuntarily.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chris Higginbotham says he's learned one thing during his time in uniform. He says people have a very easy time taking positions on the war, as long as it doesn't directly affect them. Like his own college friend, a guy who said he's very committed to the war.
And when I told him I was getting called back, we were actually out having a couple of beers, and he thought I was joking. He just stared at me. You're kidding. You're not going back. Stop messing with me. I know you're not going back. Dude, you're out. You're done. I was like, no, seriously, I'm going back. And his response was, it's so different when it becomes personal.
This is someone who is politically in favor of the war, right?
Absolutely. Very much so. Very much in favor of the war. And when he said that, when he said, it's just so much different when it affects you personally, I was very satisfied to receive that response. Because I think there's a lot of people in the world who are, you know, up to date in current affairs and think they know what's going on in the world, but and they think they know a lot about what's going on in Iraq, but they don't really have much of a connection with it. And I think I did a few stories on this in our introductory reporting class, and I would ask people, how has the war in Iraq or the war on terrorism affected you directly? And that's the response I got most times, was just silence. And a few people would say something like, well, a guy in my church had to deploy, so his wife was behind, and so we would babysit. Rarely ever did I get, well, my dad was there. My dad had to go and fight, and he was gone for 15 months. And I never got my brother went for 15 months and had to go and fight. Never got those kinds of responses. Most of what I saw was a big separation from the reality of the war.
Chris Higginbotham is due to report back to duty in May, after he finishes this year at school. He's thinking now just how much harder it will be for him to be there this time as a journalist reporting for the military.
If such and such command says they don't have enough troops to do the mission they're trying to accomplish, I'm going to have to say such and such command is overcoming great odds with limited resources to pull off a great mission for the betterment of Iraqi democracy.
And you're not believing that?
No. Now, that also brings in something like objectivity. A lot of times reporters have to report on things they don't believe in and strive for objectivity. I guess the difference here is I'm going to have to not strive for objectivity. I'm going to have to strive for a 180-degree reversal of my beliefs. So it would be one thing to have to put behind my presupposed notions and opinions in order to deliver a neutral report. But now I'm going to have to suppress my presupposed notions and beliefs and argue the company line, which is totally backwards compared to what I see.
So what are you doing to prepare for this deployment that you didn't do last time?
This time, what I really would like to focus on, instead of just telling the stories about the units and the war, just to tell the story about the soldier. You know, Ed Murrow did it, Ernie Pyle did it. These are some of the greatest journalists in history. And what they did was less of reporting on victories and losses and body counts or whatever. They talked about Joe Snuffy, you know, Sergeant Smith and Lieutenant Joseph. And that's what I'd like to do, to try to send back stories of the people who are out there sacrificing so much for this country. And some of them are doing it out of patriotism. Some of it are doing it because they're going to get college money for it. Some of them are doing it because they can't get a better job. But either way, they are out there. And regardless of whether or not they're winning, we're winning. They're doing a heck of a job down there under terrible circumstances. And I think it's very important for their stories to be told.
Chris Higginbotham is doing his master's in journalism at the University of North Carolina. He is due for reactivation in 2 months. If you have your own story to tell about this moment, at the start of the sixth year of the war in Iraq, I'd like to hear from you. You can go to our website and leave me a message there. You can find me at thestory.org. You can also leave me a telephone message. Our number is 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or write me a letter. The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. 27517. Thank you. Yesterday on the story, I talked with a Tibetan exile who lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. His name is Sherab Lama. And Sherab was giving me his assessment of the Tibetan anger he says that's causing the current clashes with Chinese authorities.
As we in Tibetan say, without the head, they use the hand first. And there is set the fire. It just not very deep in their head is always a revolution, always a, suppressed thought that they want to express. So it led, and people set cars on fire. People set stores, especially those belongs to Chinese, on fire. And this is what exactly what the Beijing want.
This is what Beijing wants, to
Absolutely.
Have a confrontation.
But maybe not at this time. But this is exactly what they always look.
Because that gives them the excuse to crack down?
This gives them then to crack down, do the silent slaughter.
In response, I had several copies of the same letter mailed to me by people who disagree with Tibet's claim to autonomy. One came from Yashangao in Durham. He wrote to complain about the use of phrases like Free Tibet and Chinese occupation of Tibet. Why don't you make a story regarding how Tibet has changed in the last 50, or especially 30 years, he asked. Your program portrays the Dalai Lama as noble and innocent, yet you choose to ignore the voice of 1.3 billion Chinese who would disagree with you. Let's get the facts straight, he wrote. Tibet was part of China since the 13th century. Even though the central government had weak control over it at times, Tibet was, is, and will be part of China. Now, because the criticism was sent out as part of a listserv, I also got a note from Tashi, who disputes the criticism. He says, I wonder if you or those who wrote similar messages have spent much time in Tibet. I've spent significant time in Tibet over the past 3 decades. It's, in fact, a very tragic situation. The primary beneficiaries of development in Tibet are Chinese migrants. Local Tibetans have not done well. And regarding your line, Tibet was, is, and will be part of China? I understand how sensitive a topic national unity is to most Chinese. That's why the Tibetan leadership's not calling for independence, but simply autonomy. Thanks to all of you who wrote. We always appreciate the feedback. Coming up tomorrow in the story, I'll talk with Armega Tafari. She's a woman in South Florida who's been homeless a number of times. Fires and hurricanes have caused her to lose apartments. This past fall, she noticed that a lot of homes were sitting empty due to foreclosure proceedings, so she and her family decided to move into one.
I don't care how hard your heart is or your head or how much of a slumlord you are. Everybody deserves to have a place to stay, and because it just so happens to be your property doesn't mean that I'm targeting you and making you responsible. I would just really apologize to that person for, trespassing, if you will. You know, what are we supposed to do?
Life as a squatter in a home that's in foreclosure. That's tomorrow on The Story. Once again, if you have suggestions of stories or an idea of one of your own you'd like to submit, go to our website. You can find me at thestory.org. I'd appreciate hearing from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.